G'day guys, welcome back to Lorefinder, Pathfinder History Podcast by the Hobbled Goblin Company. Today we're going to be learning more about Andorran, and to help me with that, I've actually have a special guest, Michael Cassavan, the artist known as Dead Aussie Gamer. Welcome, Michael.
G'day, thanks for having me.
All right, tell us a bit about you, a bit about your background in Pathfinder, and where people can find you.
You can find me around the internet at pretty much Dead Aussie Gamer. I'm more or less everywhere. At the same time, you can find me on a bunch of different channels. But I do have my own Twitch channel, twitch.tv/deadaussiegamer, and a YouTube channel, where, you know, I give advice on role-playing games, and pretty much any time someone asks me a question about role-playing games, I use the opportunity to just make a video about it and then chuck it up there, and if you like it, then people check it out. As for my experience with Pathfinder, my first actual stint into role-playing games actually came from 3.5, and during the time where 3.5 evolved into 4th Ed, I made the move, like many people did, to Pathfinder, and it very quickly became one of my, like, absolute favorite role-playing games of all times.
As it was just the spiritual successor of 3.5.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, like, the backwards compatibility was always something that I really, really loved. I absolutely just, you know, ate that up and made it a homebrew rule. It's like, yeah, if you find something in Pathfinder that may exist in 3.5, then, you know, we'll upgrade it, but otherwise just use everything from 3.5 as well and we're good.
Archetypes and things from the Dungeons and Dragons original magazines as well were so good to convert to Pathfinder.
Oh, absolutely.
Today you and I are going to be talking about Country of Andorran. What's the first thing that pops into your mind when you think of Andorran?
America! No, it's definitely the idea of the Civil War kind of colonization, you know, the spirit or the heart of liberty, definitely rings very true in the land of Andorran. I've always basically joked about it being America because it has a lot of very iconic artworks that definitely paste a very clear picture of the type of society that exists within Andorran, which, you know, I mean, as an Australian, is not something that's part of our necessary history, but something I could still appreciate a very clear image of, like, you know, being able to bring it to my tables and show to my players.
And I actually think, as an Australian, we might miss out on some of the nuances that they use. I'm sure that if you dug into a lot of the background, which we will be talking about today, there's going to be some things that we miss because we're Australian that I'm sure Americans would be like, oh, that's a mirror of this thing that happened.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look the closest we've got is, like, you know, the Alamo. You know, that was a thing. And General Custer. Yes, we know that. And there's something to do with tea in Boston. I mean, yeah.
All right, so in saying that, let's dive back into the history. When they first mapped Andorran, the Tal'Dorei's 4th Army of Exploration, something that was sent out in 1683 AR, and they mapped the lands that would one day become Andorran, as well as a lot of the ones that would become Galt and Isca later on as well. But this was the first official mapping excursion for Tal'Dorei at this point in time.
Yep. Now, for those of you who, with your history of the northern part of the Inner Sea known as Avastan, around the time when they were mapping it, it was actually colonized, well, I say colonized very loosely, it was occupied by a number of tribes that would exist in the area, ranging from the Kelids to even some of the Halets and stuff like that, just all over the place. So when the Tal'Dorei started to map out the area as well, there was actually a lot of resistance there during the exploration phases. Even though they were there to kind of scout out the area, there were still little skirmishes and battles being held across that particular area of the countryside.
Yeah, and it realistically took the better part of about 25 years for them to kind of subdue most of that and officially found it as a province of Imperial Tal'Dorei in 1707 AR. Yeah, eventually they managed to beat down all of those tribes and made it their own, or one of the many provinces of the great Imperial Tal'Dorei at the time. Of course, the main reason they did this was because of the vast lumber that was available in Andorran. It was the home to, obviously, some huge forests around the area, the Verdurin Forest being the largest. And so they started logging it and using it for shipbuilding. And because of that, Augustana became the largest shipbuilding operation and provided most of Tal'Dorei's navy well into the 2,000 years that Tal'Dorei held and the province of Andorran, really. But it peaked at 1758.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, obviously, during that period of time as well, while they were expanding through the Inner Sea region, having such a very prominent and very, very lucrative means of ship crafting also meant that they held a very particular dominance over the waterways just throughout the entire region during that period of time. It was definitely a height of Tal'Dorei ingenuity and culture as they began to spread far and wide, thanks to their new, not only the new shipbuilding opportunities, but also this desire of expanse that was now able to be reached not only by land, but also very quickly by sea.
Yeah, of course. When you have such a lucrative business, at some point in time, someone's going to take advantage of that, of course. And it's funny because the books kind of are a little bit uncertain initially of when this was founded, but the earliest source I could find said in 1853, the Lumber Consortium actually formed to help provide that steady supply of lumber out of Dark Moon Vale to Augustana to help with the Tal'Dorei Navy.
And the Lumber Consortium actually remains a major player in the adventures, even through the Tal'Dorei rulership and into the later expansion into Andorran. The Lumber Consortium acts as like this kind of criminal syndicate, a mercantile guild with their own interests and own investments that just lurk in the shadows of what's happening, you know. I think in certain ways they're a very, very interesting microcosm of like corrupt union that was often seen like kind of like throughout history, where you have corrupted officials who are interested in making more money but claim to speak on behalf of the people, which is a very interesting side by side against obviously the ideals that would later shape Andorran in the future.
Oh, definitely. But in saying that, they still supplied so much to the budding country, and even well into the time of its independence later on, they were still a major foundation for the country as a whole. But outside of that, obviously, the country itself, or the province itself at this time, started growing, started settling tracts of farmland around the Selin River and a lot of the other tributaries, because it was still a very fertile, rich soil, and that helped really grow the population very, very fast. Obviously, the main focus was still the lumber, but it meant that the people could actually feed themselves, house themselves, and grow as a province. And because of this, in 2080 AR, Tal'Dorei actually managed to conscript thousands of Andorran men into the militia to serve in the 6th Army of Exploration. They commandeered hundreds of ships from Augustana to carry them out across the Inner Sea, because the 6th Army of Exploration is one we have talked about a couple of weeks ago now. It's the ill-fated journey down to Grund in the heart of darkness in the Morwenge Expanse.
I mean, I think that expedition is definitely one of those ones that I think is more covered in the Morwenge Expanse books, but the short of it is that around this period of time, Tal'Dorei, as I mentioned, was like all obsessed with trying to, you know, kind of conquer as much of the world as possible, stretching out from Andorran to Cheliax to Morwenge to what was it called? Sargeva? No, that's not right.
Sargeva?
Thank you, yeah. Some of them succeeded, obviously, with Andorran, but yeah, those expanses became very expensive, and the actual operation to be able to settle these places or to try and conquer these places became more and more increasingly difficult as time went on. Which, for Tal'Dorei, was a horrible thing, because obviously it meant more resources being poured into these explorations. But at the same time, for places like Andorran, they were making money. They were actually solidifying their position within the world. And I think, at least personally, I think that the expanse was one of the many reasons as to why Andorran ended up succeeding as well as it did, because it was an opportunity for them to basically utilize the resources coming from Tal'Dorei to build something else.
Yeah, and to almost be able to free themselves and use that basis as an outreach to other countries to start exporting goods and things like that as well.
Exactly.
We're going to skip forward, though, 1900 years from that point. Not a lot happens in Andorran, as it's well settled as the lumber supply for the Tal'Dorean Navy. They just basically churn through and just keep that ticking for almost 2,000 years. Until something happens in Dark Moon Vale. Something that became known as the Rending. When Droska's Crag erupted. It's a volcano sitting on the just on the edge of the Five Kings Mountains, bordering the Darkmoon Vale, and it caused widespread devastation within the Vale. Because of the eruption, the river became so flooded that sections of the city of Ulmus washed away. Crevices opened above the Candlestone Caverns, providing surface access to the Court of Ether for the first time as well. Pretty devastating impact, in all honesty. For those who don't know, the Court of Ether is an inverted city. It's built among and in the stalactites that form the roof of the Endless Gulf. You read much about that one?
From what I understand, the catastrophe that was the Rending, the Fae there were like super upset, super angry. I read something like they, because obviously so much of the natural world was tied into the forested areas, and with the growing expansion of the humans from the region, the fairies and the fae folk started to build a lot of resentment towards the Andoran during or after that particular event, because there was even less of the natural or the wild world left standing after that.
Exactly, and because it made this crack that led to the Court of Ether. So the Court of Ether is actually, as I said, the inverted city, but it's run by the Dark Fae, like the Evil Fae, Queen Frilogama. And it's basically home to just the worst Fae you can think of. Gremlins, Mites, Red Caps, Pixies, a mix of smaller, lesser Dark Fae races. But it gave them direct access from the Darklands now into Darkmoon Vale. And that's what really kicked off this man versus Fae. Because the Fae that were already living there and in that region were relatively, like, they were pissed off, they were annoyed, but they'd come to a working agreement until the Dark Fae were like, no, not anymore. We're here now. We're going to kick your asses.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Kicking on from there, things start to ramp up a lot in Andoran. At the time, about 100 years later, this is when Cheliax is starting to get a little bit tense and iffy with Taldor, starting to give it a lot of pushback, so Admiral Janice Retoran of West Crown started providing warships and writs of course to sailors in Augustana, encouraging them to attack Teldon merchant vessels. Surprisingly, establishing the routes of the Grey Corsair Eagle Knight division at some point. They weren't known as the Eagle Knights at this point in time, they were still just the Grey Corsairs. But it's very reminiscent of some writs that were handed out during a certain civil war in our world.
Absolutely. And for those of you who don't know what the writs were, it was almost like a pardon in advance for a particular type of lawless action, or what would be considered a lawless action on behalf of particular regions or particular interests. For example, a lot of privateers in a particular area, which will remain unnamed, used to receive writs to attack ships that bore the flag of a particular country. So while, say for example, if you were an English sailor sailing the English flag, you were perfectly fine because the local pirates, as it were of no interest to you. But if you flew the Spanish flag and you had a writ from the crown, you were then permitted to attack them, bring down their ships, and of course keep whatever you found on that ship as a means to not only further the interests of that particular nation, but also to avoid the law because you had, quote-unquote, you had the writ to that bounty, to that loot.
You are pre-pardoned.
Yeah, you're pre-pardoned for your crimes. So in this particular instance, yeah, that's exactly what they were doing here. Again, to kind of touch on, quote-unquote, stuff from the past to stuff from the future, this being the establishing route of the Grey Corsairs is very on brand because, as many of you would know, what later becomes the Eagle Knights, they don't really operate like a navy, or they don't really operate in the traditional sense of like an army or a military. They have a lot of freedom and a lot of ability to, I guess, dictate their own course of actions that serve the interests of their morals versus a particular parliament or a particular group of individuals, if that makes sense.
Which, 2 years later, of course, after doing this, as part of the Eventongue conquest, they managed to get Andoran to renounce its ties with Taldor and actually become part of the Chelaxian nation. So it went from being the province of Taldor to being the province of Cheliax in 4081 AR.
One thing I've always been curious as is the why. You know, like, for me, it seemed like there was a bartering cause in there, you know what I mean? Like, there must have been something that must have been of value that Cheliax must have given or procured for that to be relinquished, you know what I mean? Because At this stage in the history, we know that Andoran is a primary source of lumber, primary source of, like, ships and materials, fertile farming lands, you know what I mean? Like, why would Taldor give all that up, you know?
They didn't necessarily give it up so much as they didn't have any way to not to stop it from happening. Mm. 2 years earlier, the Quadiran invasion of southern Taldor had happened.
Oh.
And because of this, a vast majority of Taldor's navy and military was now on that long border between Taldor and Kadira to stop any further incursions. And so Cheliax was like, all your guys are over there. You can do nothing about everything over here. And yeah, so they just went through and they annexed Galt, Iska, and Doran. Even the wingmen of Devil's Perch were like, yeah, okay, we'll join you. And Cheliax just expanded in this huge bound in 1 year.
Mm.
And Taldor couldn't do anything because they couldn't fight a war on two fronts. Because it was bad enough the Kadirans had already kicked their ass 2 years earlier. They knew they couldn't stand up to the combined might, especially with Andoran being where their ships were made.
Mm.
They couldn't get any more ships now either.
That's awesome. That's really cool. I like that.
And so because of that, Andoran starts churning out ships for the Chalaxian Navy and some for their own. Because it's now that they start building up a little bit more of their own things as well.
For those interested, Cheliax actually also boasts one of the greatest navies in the Pathfinder setting. Yeah, having performed countless maritime, how can I put it? Like, see this region of the sea? This belongs to Cheliax. You can't do that.
Yeah, they patrol large swaths of the inner sea and, like, outside the Arch of Ireland, and they're just like, this is ours now. An extension of our province.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, you can't put a flag down in the middle of the ocean. Go away.
And yet no one can stop them. We're going to talk about Cheliax in a couple of weeks with another guest, and I'm going to definitely go into more depth than that because they've got some amazing ships with some amazing histories, and it's definitely something that's going to come up.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to let you take this next one because I know that this was your first step into Pathfinder, really.
Yeah, no, this was. So pretty much about maybe 20, 30 years after, you know, the ties to Taldor were renounced, Karas the Falcon Novetrin, who is a very notable character from the early Pathfinder first edition days, entered Darkmoon Vale and began to pacify the otherwise wide lawless region, which actually was covered in a number of early edition Pathfinder books back in 3.5, such as the Darkmoon Vale and Falcon's Hollow, which are two wonderful, wonderful books. And Falcon's Hollow was actually named after, of course, Karas themselves, where you actually got to go and relinquish some bandits from their quote-unquote new home in the fortress. It was it's a great adventure, and if you have not played it, yeah, it's definitely worth checking out. I don't want to spoil anything because I tend to do that when I talk about adventures. I tend to blabbermouth a bit.
Yeah, and that's the Hollow's Last Hope adventure.
Yeah. One of the things when I first introduced myself into Pathfinder was it has just such a strong classic medieval fantasy adventure vibe, like this whole particular thing. So yeah. Anyway, moving on. Pretty much from here, the nation of Andoran kind of continued its expansion and its growth. And in 4246, explorers on a small island, small Aslanti island in the Arcadian Ocean, founded a colony called the Sun Temple Colony. There's tons of stuff that we can go into there, as Aslant was previously kind of like Atlantis, like it's kind of like the birthplace of humanity, the place where everything began. It was destroyed many, many years ago, and the ruins that now litter the outer skirts of those islands, these tiny little small portions of land that now exist in the middle of the ocean, all that's left, and they are known as the Aslanti Islands.
That colony itself was lost less than 100 years after it was founded as well. Like, all communication just stopped with that colony, and it just, no one knows what happened to it. In saying that, there is a really good, cool, like, interesting gazette about it in the Lost Cities of Galarian.
Again, I don't want to spoil anything, but just so that you guys know that there is an adventure path out there for Pathfinder First Edition. Just saying, that may or may not, because I'm not spoiling anything, that may or may not cover stuff on the island called the Ruins of Aslant, if anyone wants to check that out. But, you know, again, I'm not spoiling anything. I promised I wouldn't.
Yeah, that outpost is definitely one that you can have a look at. In fact, I think you can say the adventure path. The adventure path is, of course, the ruins of Aslan. Adventure path.
Yes, yes.
Takes a place in Aslan. And that's all the information we're going to give you on that.
Yeah,
it's a great read for any DMs out there as well, though.
And I don't count this as a spoiler, but part one is called The Lost Outpost.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Pretty much. All right, so after that, we have actually the forming of the Eagle Knights about 400 years later. King Coolium II forms the Eagle Knights, and their mission was actually to provide an honor guard for Aridin when he returned 6 years later, which... If you're listening to this podcast, we've mentioned multiple times on this occasion, on this point in time, he did not.
Mm.
The earth shook. The Eye of Abednego appeared. Storms racked the whole world for 3 weeks, and the faith of the Chalaxians crumbled. Panic swept through Andorran as their god had disappeared. And during this time, obviously, civil war in Cheliax broke out and lasted for over 50 years. Until 4660, where the Thrun Ascendancy happened in Cheliax. Diabolists took control of the houses of power, and they brought their cruel sensibilities to bear. 2 years later, a Galton philosopher, Dal Djubanic, wrote On Government, and basically it was like his ideas about the Chelish government's terrible betrayal of humanity. And it was from these words that 7 years later, in 4669 AR, revolution rose. So Andorran decided in that year to declare itself independence from Cheliax. And they established common rule. They recognized that it was danger for their fledgling democracy, that the government repurposed all of those Eagle Knights that were originally supposed to be the honor guard of Aridin, and they used them to protect Andorran instead. Cheliax obviously kicked up their skirts and got annoyed and set about with their giant navy of putting a 20-year embargo on Andorran. Until 4689, where Andorran used their own fleet to sink three of the Chelish warships just outside of Westcrown. They took the fight to Cheliax, and they took down three warships, one of which was actually the Chelish flagship of the fleet. So that's a lot of stuff that happened. We're going to backtrack a little bit. Common rule, just for those at home playing at home that aren't 100% sure what it is, it's a philosophy based on the concept that everyone is inherently equal in importance and that no individual has the right to force his or own beliefs upon another. Sound vaguely familiar to anyone?
Yeah, maybe just a little. I mean, you'd have to think about, you know, how independent that thought would have to be for people to come up with this very original series of rules. No, it's great. You know, honestly, like I said, when it comes down to it, one thing I love about Pathfinder more than anything else is how they can draw upon a lot of real-world history and apply it with a fantasy spin on it. For me, this is the... I guess, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but this is the height of Andorran gameplay, right? Like, this is the time that I think all the excitement, all the energy, all that vibe of, like, you know, fighting down the revolution, you know, striking out against Cheliax. This is the moment where I think a lot of adventures, heroes were made, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, even, like, the notion of, like, sinking the Chelish flagship, you know, I mean, that invokes just so much, you know, spirit of adventure, and, it, you know, you could even have, you know, just this whole adventure geared around that one campaign where they sneak into Cheliax and do that. A bunch of, like, ragtag soldiers going up against the big might of the Chelish who had just beaten down a rebellion, you know, because it wasn't that long when, you know, Thrun ascended and basically got everything in order.
And yeah, I think that is one of the things that makes adventuring in Andorran so interesting. Obviously, the ties you can make to the real world, but also the way that they've gone about it is kind of very interesting as well. But it also obviously leads to great similarities in my mind already ring with War of the Crown. Could have been realistically set in either.
Yeah, place, yeah, almost. I could definitely see that.
Political intrigue-wise. I know that the Rollmongers team is apparently running a very similar political game in Andorran instead of Tal'dor. But back to our history. Let's dive back into that. So a year after they declared independence and established common rule, a delegation of Gilman. For those who don't know, Gilman are essentially part of the Aslani people when the Aslan was hit. Those who survived, basically, used their magic, and they were actually flesh-warped almost, and became Gilman, part of them. Those who didn't survive as normal Aslanti humans. So they arrive in Almas, and they bring a gift of the Keystone to the Arch of Aridon, which is a giant arch that stretches from the continent of Avastan to the continent of Gurund, and it's basically the mouth between the Inner Sea and the Arcadian Ocean. And so they brought with them the Keystone from that arch, gave it to the fledgling nation of Andorran as a sign that they supported their cause and their beliefs. How they got it, I'm not 100%, but, I mean, Gilman fell into the ocean, so it kind of makes sense.
Oh yeah, one could imagine exactly that. I think here as well, Gilman's arrival and the alliance that is being made was not only a good way, a great throwback to the explorations of the Lost Colony, but also it now showed that Cheliax had to worry about more in the Inner Sea region than just, you know, other warships and stuff like that. The Gilman presented a major political shift in that whole area, because now not only did they have the ships in tow, but they also had the people that lived, resided, and occupied that area as well. People that, you know, as you can imagine, there's not much you can really do if a tribe of Gilman decide to undergo a hostile attack against you for entering a particular space. It becomes an entirely different fight.
Yeah, you bought a boat to a sea fight.
Yeah, no, so what happens if we, you know, just sort of take these, like, $5 Bunnings screws and just sort of, like, you know, just poke holes down on the bottom of your ship here? You know, it's a whole other thing, and, you know, I don't know about you, but I've noticed that Hell Knights don't float, so, I mean...
Yeah, they don't float very well at all. I mean, my last character did, but not everyone's does. But now we start, and this is, obviously, it's only gained independence in 4669. It took all of 22 years, I think, before some corruption starts showing through. So in 4691, one of Taldor's dukes on their western border mounts an expedition to take back the rebellious province, quote-unquote, and they lay waste to one of the eastern counties, basically, of Andorran, before Andorran managed to gather its armies, and the Eagle Knights kind of charged in. And because of it, they kind of got more important within the view of the populace. But then rumors started to spread throughout the country that perhaps the Eagle Knights had engineered the whole thing themselves. Mm. And so it kind of starts showing that, like, this whole common rule, this idea that every man is equal, already is showing some of its flaws.
I think this was a great turning point, because it shows that even the most perfect ideals can, of course, become subject to the corruptions and greed of people in charge. Which I think, I don't know if we've mentioned this before, but Andorran is actually a people's council. So there is no, like, singular ruler, as it were, that resides over all of Andorran. This particular point here, where the Eagle Knights have been mobilized, up until this point, the Eagle Knights have been little more than a militia. I think at this point is when, I mean, I might be wrong on this, but I think this is where they established the Steel Falcons, which were the, like, they kind of have the Eagle Knights who uphold the militia and the people's ideals, and then you had the Steel Falcon who, in future, fight against defending and acting as a military on behalf of the country because of, you know, the rumors, suspicions, and the multifaceted intrigue that seems to have been happening during this region.
And we will go into that a little bit more a little late, like in the next section as well, because there's definitely multiple parts of the Eagle Knights, multiple moving sections of it, and they all have their own different reasons for being. This corruption aside, it's only 6 years later that the Goblin War actually threatens not just Andorran, but the whole region in general. So essentially, these Hobgoblin commanders got together all these goblin tribes within the Chitterwood in Iska, and they just launched this all-out assaults from Vrissia all the way through to Taldor. And so you just had all of these countries, including the Five Kings Mountains as well. Cheliax got hit, Druma, like Andorran, Iska, Galt, even as far away as Vrissia. Like, that's the size of the hundreds of tribes all under the organization of Hobgoblins.
Can I just say, also, side note, I love hobgoblins, especially Pathfinder hobgoblins. I love them more than orcs in my campaigns, because the hobgoblins have such a powerful military mindset, when it comes to how they run and how they organize. The way that they command other goblins as lesser goblins, the way they manage themselves. Even their society is entirely built upon the idea of war and battle and rising in rank and command and doing what's necessary to be not the physically strongest, but the most powerful through military might and conquest. It really, I mean, if you understand hobgoblins well, you understand the wake that gets left behind during this expanse. You know, like when you think like, oh, these goblins are rampaging through the countryside, most people default to like a swarm, you know, like kind of like a Zerg rush running through the landscape. But that's not it. With the Goblin Blood Wars, it was an unrelenting march of very, very highly trained and militarized human-sized goblins who had tamed, you know, tribe after tribe of these goblins for their masses and had been commanding them with the military might that rivals any of the other nations. It was a huge threat. It was a massive threat.
Well, it was essentially the glaring equivalent of a blitzkrieg, because when you take hundreds of goblins and march them across the land, they eat everything in their path.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
As well.
They're voracious. A single goblin will eat 8 to 10 times the equivalent of a human adult. It's tons of resources.
And imagine taking hundreds of them, marching them forward through these lush lands that are there to support some of the largest cities in Galarian, and you've just got hundreds of goblins eating all of the food as they march. The hobgoblins did everything short of salting the earth in their way.
I mean, if you want to look in some extra detail here, it was actually this act that also started spreading out the multitude of goblin tribes throughout the entire region between Varisia and Tal'dor, because as you know, the goblins grew tired, grew weary, became useless, quote unquote, they would then branch off and be left behind to just continue to hound, bother, and otherwise make a nuisance of themselves where they went, meaning that the hobgoblins never had to fear anything from the people from where they had left behind, because there were always going to be goblins left behind where they were.
This war lasted 4 years before all the different countries got together and really pushed it back. Like a small order of Hell Knights, you had the Druma's Mercenary League, and then the regiment of the Eagle Knights of Andor. They all combined forces to fight the Goblin Horde. An unknown number of dead on both sides. It wasn't just the goblins that copped it. It was the humans as well. And the dwarves. Druma's Mercenary League was definitely filled with dwarves as well. So it was a human and dwarf offensive that just left like an unknown amount of people dead.
It kind of had a, if you've ever played like the original Warcraft, you know, it definitely had that kind of vibe when I was reading about it.
From there, obviously ended in 4701. 4704, the People's Council elected Codwin I of Augustana as the supreme elect of Andorran. He would go on to be re-elected multiple times during this time. After his third election in 4712, which he only just won in that time, basically opposition within the People's Council kind of put forth a motion that restricted the Supreme Elect 3 terms in office. Again, eerily similar to a certain country. Yeah, so they've got this in there now where you can only have 3 terms in office because of Codwin and his popularity within the People's Council. Unfortunately, during his time, the city of Almus was struck with a very well-known serial killer, the Portside Strangler, who was caught and executed, but the murders that bore his trademark kept happening and still happening to this day. That was in 4709. Current Galarian calendar is 4721, and those murders still happen in Almus to this day.
I always like the idea of serial killers in fantasy games, because a lot of people think that just because a period of time has passed, like, oh, maybe the killings have stopped. And, you know, like, if 4709 was 2009, if we want to equate timelines, and the current year is 4721. So, you know, one would think that, you know, after about, like, what, 11 years, 12 years, the, you know, people would have forgotten, or maybe there's no killer, or maybe there's only copycats now. But you think in a fantasy world, like, where the culprit could be, say, an elf.
Yeah, elf or dwarf, or surprisingly even a gnome if they're that twisted.
And, you know, it could literally be anyone. It could be, you know, the murders could go for ages. So it's a much scarier thought. And I loved the idea of, like, you know, kind of like the Jack the Ripper kind of, like, I love the kind of, you know, there's, like, really old school, like, nicknames they give killers, you know? The Portside Strangler, you know, is just...
It definitely has that piratey lean to it.
It really does. It absolutely does.
And that lead us up to kind of one of the most current things, 4716. Andira Marisek was actually elected the Supreme Elect after Cobwin I, obviously had his third term in office. She's a really interesting choice for a Supreme Elect, ex-Steel Falcon, Eagle Knight, who worked with the Bellflower Network, which is a network of halflings trying to help the halfling slaves in Cheliax. She works all across. If you actually have a look at her background and her political career, like, she's partnered with the Grand Princess Stavian, even though she doesn't necessarily like King Stavian III. She works with Queen Talendia Edessaril of Kionan. Even on the clandestine side of it, she still works with the new leader in Galt to try and destroy the final blades and end the worst excess of the Red Revolution. So she's got her hands in all of these pots. So she's much more, because of the Steel Falcons do tend to be a little bit more outward looking than the Golden Legionnaires, she's got her hand in a lot of different working things outside of the actual country of Andorran as well, to try and make the world, not just Andorran, a better place.
No, absolutely. And the interesting thing that we can probably bring up here as well is that as we lead into the more modern takes of what's happening with Cheliax, this is actually some of the crucial moments that will eventually form what will become known as the Shining Kingdoms.
Do you want to go a little bit into that now?
Seeing as we're talking about history, let's talk about modern days. So, as Pathfinder found itself moving through its own age, a huge shift in power, of course, happening from the middle of what is now known as the Eye of Dread, nations began to form and create alliances and kingdoms. Most notably in the region was the Shining Kingdoms, which saw the alliances between Andoran, Drumah, the Five King Mountains, Galt, Kionan, and Tal'Dor. So all of them banded together, obviously with a number of shared interests in trying to protect this region from a number of different threats. I mean, there's still obviously the political intrigue that exists between them, but things such as the resurgence of the Hobgoblins, of course, Tar Baphon and his armies of the undead up to the north, in the uncertain times that existed, Andoran and these other fellow kingdoms have put their historical grievances aside somewhat in order to attempt to fend off incursions into their region. But one thing that was also very interesting about that is that while they have banded together to help each other out, there are still massive threats, especially from what is now known as Old Cheliax, which has likewise done the same and consolidated the various nations in their empires. So Andoran being on a shared border to Cheliax with Drumah, they've become more of an opposed dichotomy with that kingdom than ever before. So that's kind of like where we're kind of looking at, like, modern, where Andoran is at the moment, is part of the Shining Kingdoms and battling the forces of the old Chelish Empire.
And that catches us up to the modern time. We're going to take a quick music break right now, and we're going to come back with some more about the current outlook of Andorran. Join us soon.
All right, guys, so now we're going to talk about Andoran now and the geology of what you can find within this region. So starting with the region surrounding the capital of Almas, which is the city at the capital of Andoran, is, of course, the Almas Surrounds. It is mostly like these wide plains that is being divided in half by the Andoran River. To the west of that, we have the Arthfell region, which covers both the Arthfell Mountains, the Arthfell Forest, as well as the Nogotha Peaks. As we journey northward towards Dark Moon Vale, we actually see that there are a number of regions here just on the shadow of the Five King Mountains. The Vale itself, as well as the Dark Moon Plain and Wolf Hill Run, are a number of different locations in that region. Making our way eastward, there is the Vedran Forest, which houses a number of different towns and cities that are kind of in mixed with the massive forest along that area, with the Selen and the Dragonfly River sharing a border with, of course, their neighbors just across the other way. So this kind of represents the bordered edge of Andoran. And then heading down back towards the south is the Carpendon Plains, which is a wide area which has had many expanses over the years. It is full of a lot of the agriculture that now supports Andoran and is very close to the capital city, making it great for trade, supporting pretty much the whole nation. In Australia, we have a place called the Wheat Belt, which provides a lot of the natural resources to WA, which is where I live. It functions in a very, very similar way.
It is basically the breadbasket of Andoran, producing fruit, cheese, grain, olives, grapes, even wine, and a heap of other vegetables as well. But not just for domestic consumption, but also for export. Last week we talked about the fact that Absalom's Aeon Stones are starting to fail, and so Andoran has become one of the leading exporters of food to Absalom because of this.
Mm.
Each of these regions is obviously dominated by some of the biggest cities around Andoran. Obviously the capital being Almus, metropolis of 76,000 people, mostly humans, dwarves, halflings, elves, a few half-orcs and gnomes as well. And it's kind of the first base most people who land on Almus' shores land in. It's where the people's revolt was kind of centered around. It's also where the Gilman arrived and gave them the Arch of Aradin's keystone. A lot of huge things have happened in Almus. Quick overview of a couple of other cities. You got Augustana, as we've mentioned several times before, being the center of shipbuilding and production, also for the export of lumber. Most of it leads from Augustana. You have the city of Belus, actually in Verduren Forest. That is a weird, hard one to say, isn't it?
Verduren
Forest. So Belus is actually quite close to the border of Galt, basically. It's a river settlement that kind of sits between the forest itself and the River Selen, right on the edge, and is the easiest way to get to Galt from Andoran. And so if you're coming through that way, that's probably your first stop. On the other side of that forest, we have Carpendon itself. That's obviously the capital of the Carpendon Plains, which is, obviously, as we were talking about just then, the breadbasket of Andoran. Then we've got a couple that, again, I'm going to leave to you because I know that your first Pathfinder loves.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, of course, in the north of Andoran, in Darkmoon Vale, the capital there is Falcon's Hollow, which is, of course, named after the very famous liberator of the region from bandits and the like, Karas the Falcon Novotinian. That's how I'm going to say it. That particular region serves at keeping a lot of the spooky things that have crept or crawled from the new passageways to the Underdark kind of at bay, with a number of very dejected civilians that seem to wander around the areas. You find out stories like, oh, my child's a werewolf. Is that right? Yeah, they're a werewolf. Okay, cool. No worries. Good on you, small child. You know, like, literally this is kind of like if someone, you know, basically went, hey, you know what we should do? We should ask Stephen King write, like, this tiny forest of stories. And they just put it there, and that's where it is. It's, like, full of, like, this really cool, spooky stuff that has that very, very nice, cool things there.
Very dark, messed up place, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But then you've also got a couple of other cities or towns within Darkmoon.
Yes, of course. I always forget the other ones. So then you've also got Ulfden. Now, Ulfden is, I want to say, like, is it a sister city? I kind of feel like it's a sister city to Orgiant.
Origin?
Yeah.
So Origin, I think, originally was founded by the Lumber Consortium itself. So it's the home base for the Lumber Consortium. They founded it in 4138, I think. This is the reason that you'll find multiple different dates for the founding of the Lumber Consortium. Some people don't attribute it to being a thing until they founded Origin, when they really should have just been like, well, no, actually, they founded it in 18-whatever, but they didn't found this city until much, much later.
Yeah, and then, of course, the Ulfden is the home base to the Diamond Regiment, which is the Andoran army that, you know, kind of is comprised of, like, a bunch of knights, Eagle Knights, regular army soldiers and the like, who make sure that kind of, like, obviously, as I mentioned, Darkwood is kind of a dangerous place, especially with, you know, so many ties to Darklands. They kind of act as, like, merchants and protectors of traders and, you know, they kind of just secure all the resources that come from the Dark Moon Vale.
And that was founded by Berendo Novotnian, the nephew of Karis Novotnian.
Yeah, so that's why I was always curious. Like, I always thought, like, maybe they were, like, sister... You know, like, there's a clear connection between the two places. Like, one is, like, all the merchants gathering resources and stuff like that from the region, and then these guys are the ones who send the protectors and the army members. You know what I mean? Like...
Yeah, for sure. I also think one thing we haven't mentioned that I think we definitely should. One of the reasons Andorran is so rich is because of its large oversupply of darkwood. And that's... If the forests in the region are so old, that is how the Lumber Consortium made so much money. Darkwood, obviously being much harder and stronger than most other woods, makes it perfect for making shields and ships and weapon halves and things like that, because it's almost as strong as steel.
Yeah, it's a very valuable commodity. You know, I think in other languages, it's also known as iron bark, and yeah, it's very, very synonymous with, especially druids, who... have an anathema to metal and refined minerals and ores for them to be able to utilize powerful tools to be able to protect themselves and defend the woods that they guard.
Gives them a nice bit of armor that they wouldn't otherwise get.
Mm.
Now we're just going to quickly dive into something that's going to help all the DMs out there. Some of the organizations that really run or take part in a lot of the things that happen within Andorran. Obviously, the first and foremost, the biggest one that we've touched on a little bit is the Eagle Knights itself. So the Eagle Knights, they're essentially sworn to protect their homeland and to destroy slavery and those who profit from it. This has led to them working not just as soldiers, but also as moles inside of slaving organizations and some of the more evil organizations throughout Galarian. There is three separate branches within the Eagle Knights. You've got the Golden Legion, commanded by General Hadrick Traxus, operated alongside the nation's military itself. So these are, keeping in mind, they still have a standing army. These Eagle Knights are much more trained soldiers, basically.
They're career soldiers. They're the ones who not only focus on upholding the ideals of freedom and liberty and rescuing people, but are definitely, like, dedicated to it. They don't have, like, you know, day lives, as it were. It's like, this is what they do.
Even in saying that, so these Gold Legionnaires, basically, they're like the elite adjunct units. They double as field commanders, trainers, depending on whatever the need is. Their primary role is obviously guarding Andorran's border. These are the really out there ones. And to also guard the interior trade routes, keep a watchful eye on the nation's wilder regions. And yeah, so that's the Golden Legionnaires. You can actually play as a Golden Legionnaire Prestige class in 1st edition. That's in Pathfinder campaign settings, Paths of Prestige. And that's its own Prestige class outside of the Eagle Knight Prestige class, which is, again, its own Prestige class within the Faction Guide Pathfinder campaign setting book as well.
Yeah, and unless I'm mistaken, I believe it's an archetype now in 2nd edition for you to be able to use.
Oh, very nice. I would have no idea. But
there is a theme template for it. Oh no, it is an archetype. Yeah, because these are the things for the archetype. So yeah, it's in the character guide, page 128, for those of you playing 2nd edition.
Then we step into our second group of Eagle Knights, the ones that we have touched on again. This is where Supreme Elect Andira Murasek has come from. The Steel Falcons. So she was currently their most current leader before she actually took over the role of Supreme Elect. And who it is now is completely unknown. And that's because they're not really bound to serve as defenders of Andorran proper. They're not really supposed to stay stateside. This is your overseas, act out in other people's jurisdiction force. Their key biggest role is really to oppose slavery throughout the Inner Sea region as a whole. They work alongside the Andorran Navy. They combat slave ships. As we mentioned, the Grey Corsairs kind of fall within the Steel Falcons' purview as well.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they're those... what's the American force that works overseas and not within the country? The CIA, isn't it? They work overseas, not within... The FBI is within the country.
Look, we have ASIO. That's what we have. So, I mean...
There are ASIO equivalent, which I think is the CIA equivalent for America. Again, Steel Falcons, because even though they never have a campaign path in Andorran, you can play as all of these Eagle Knight breakouts. There is a Steel Falcon Prestige class within Andorran Spirit of Liberty, Pathfinder Player Companion for 1st Edition, and there's also a Grey Corsair separate Prestige class within Adventure within the Pathfinder RPG Adventurer's Guide. Again, not sure about 2nd.
I don't think that there is any variations on the Eagle Knight yet, outside of the archetype I just mentioned. But if you really want to impress your GM when you bust out your Eagle Knight, say, I wish to be a member of the Grey Corsairs, or the Twilight Talon, you know, you could be, you know, just try to really throw them for a loop.
Lead straight into what the Twilight Talons are. So they're not even publicly known or acknowledged by the government. The Steel Falcons do shady stuff outside of the country. The Twilight Talons just do shady stuff. Mm. So they serve as like the spies, the saboteurs, the really deep cover agents, and the assassins.
The quote-unquote greater good.
For the greater good. And once more, there is a 1st edition prestige class, because there's pretty much a 1st edition prestige class for everything for a Twilight Talon. This is also in the Adventurer's Guide, just like the Grey Corsair. And that kind of wraps up those Eagle Knight, different Eagle Knights and their sub-branches within. Our next organization we're going to take a quick look at, the Lumber Consortium. Pretty powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to give everyone a quick rundown of that, please?
Yeah, sure. So as you know, we kind of mentioned very, very briefly, the Lumber Consortium is a syndicate of mercantile guildsmen who bonded together over the lucrative investment into the lumbering of the Dark Moon Vale and the Darkwood that's there. But, you know, as everyone knows, power and money corrupt very, very much so. So over time, this organization accrued enough power and influence to start manipulating things from behind the scenes. And little is known about them because they are everyone. They are the people. They are the workers. They are the force that created the foundations, that the brick and mortar, as it were, or in this case, probably wood, that Andoran was built upon. It all did start originally with a single family who kind of then, for the age of Berendo Novotinian, who had founded the city of Olthen, which is what now they're head of operations. But prior to that, it pretty much had established itself in a number of different cities, a number of different political places, and eventually was known to even do secret dealings with places like Thrun and Cheliak, even amidst the wars that were occurring between their actual factions.
So I think it was originally founded by Taras Rakesclaw.
That's the one, yes.
When he bought out Berendo Novotinian's stakes in the lumber of Darkmoon Vale, basically.
Yeah, that was what I was thinking of. So pretty much they are just very, very self-interested, and they have always remained so. Money is power, and that is all they really seek. They want power, they want influence, they want to remain in their very, very lofty positions, because Andoran has no noble caste, as it were. There's no people who are, you know, kind of sitting pretty in the big castles and stuff like that. The closest equivalent to that would be the members of the Lumber Consortium, who don't necessarily flaunt their opulence and their wealth and stuff, because it's kind of not done in Andoran, but they do play the same games as the Tal'dans and the like. I think most notable, there were a couple of notable members among this particular group that I think any good role player should definitely read up a little bit about, and that is Thuldren Creed, who is known as, you know, kind of this savage, sadistic, basically just this kind of like Burgermeister that kind of keeps the town of Falcon Hollow in check. And everyone kind of really hates having to deal with him because he is very pushy and gets everyone to kind of do what he wants, because again, he's part of the Lumber Consortium. So, you know, he quote unquote is in charge, as it were. And the people of Falcon Hollow are not members, and they don't, you know, kind of understand and don't have any rights to if they want to keep their jobs, you know. The next character would be Sedrog Deadknuckle, who very similarly is also in charge of the region of Ulregent in Andoran itself, and Bruiser Tor, who is an enforcer in that same region there. The two of them are quite a dangerous combination of characters who represent that sense of not having to be noble to be corrupt, and not having to be noble to you know, use your power to keep civilians and keep the people down.
But obviously, having something like this Lumber Consortium in Darkmoon Vale, cutting down all of these very, very ancient trees, they're going to tick off some really powerful people, which leads to a very interesting organization within Andorran, within but not within. These are the primordial ones. So they're a sect of secretive, as all druids are, a druidic, matriarchal druid circle. Super, super ancient, though. So within this circle, they call themselves the Keth. And they consider themselves to be descendants of the first humans. So strong is their belief that they actually believe they were the humans created by the eldest in the first world before Galarian was created. And they have this huge sense of superiority because of it.
Oh, yeah. Which is super ironic given that Taldor is also right there.
Yeah, exactly right. They're sitting right between all of them and they're just like, no, we're still better than all of you.
Yep.
Like the Fae, though, they pretty much walk around naked all the time, paint themselves up, different paints, decorate their bodies basically with elaborate scarring, tattooing, mystical designs from long-forgotten eras, realistically. The Keth believe that these markings bear their soul and cover the tattoos and scars when travelling outside of their villages in case an enemy sees a symbol and gains power over them. So they're still very sacrosanct in their belief system. They pretty much don't have much to do with civilized, quote-unquote, humans. Though they just don't, so because they're just like the Fae, they just avoid them. They will interact with non-Keth druids from elsewhere within the forest and treat them kindly, but they refuse to share any of their practices or rituals. Once a year, though, they will kind of get any of their druidic knowledge and things like that from their own tribe, and they do include within their tribe, because there's a lot of non-druids in these villages, and they kind of share that within the tribe itself of these Keth pure blood people. Isolationist belief system, but it also puts them quite at odds with a lot of the Lumber Consortium especially, who often encroach upon these villages unknowingly. Still leads to some fun interactions.
Oh, absolutely, especially if you're looking at groups where PC wants to explore or playing someone who is curious or trying to find information about these rituals involved with them. It sets up a wonderful piece of roleplay for that interaction, because especially any kind of interaction with xenophobic orders or tribes or people is always a fun thing to try and do as a GM.
Yeah, a lot of good fun RP in that one, especially when they only speak Sylvan and Druidic.
Yeah, that's true.
So you need to have like certain languages if you want to even talk to them.
Yep.
So we've got one more organization to chat about.
Now, I spoke very briefly about how in Andorran there weren't any real noble houses. Like, that wasn't really the done thing. The next organization is actually a noble house, or series of noble houses called the Seven Houses, which actually is a secret Andorran society of aristocrats who are trying to restore wealth and power and that sense of nobility from Taldor that they believe was lost during the People's Revolt. So this is a whole other story, which I love. The fact that rather than, you know, kind of the bourgeois underdog artist living in the streets trying to, like, kind of hide themselves from the aristocrats, you now have these aristocrats who are trying to hide themselves from the people's council, trying to do their best to undermine what has been built by the people. It's a very poetic and very lovely twist on that traditional story, which I just, I love. I eat that up.
100%. And if you're doing any kind of adventure within Augustana, which is where the headquarters of the secret society is, the Seven Houses, mm-hmm. It's definitely something you can bring into play as that kind of counterpoint to the noble common rule of the area. The leader is Madame Revenge. They don't ever name any of the other houses involved, so basically you've got six free slots there to fill with some evil thoughted nobles that you want to, and it could really help you bleed some more information into a adventure that is set in Augustana.
Mm.
But that wraps up our quick dive into Andorran. We're just going to take a quick musical break again, come back and just drop a couple of the adventures, modules and society games that happen in Andorran, and I'm also going to throw the question of what is Dead Aussie Gamer's favourite Pathfinder creature. Alright guys, we'll be right back. G'day guys, welcome back. As mentioned, we're going to talk about some of the modules, society games, and the brief touching point of an adventure path that happens in Andorran. as much support as it's gotten in and fleshed out in obviously two different books, Spirit of Liberty and Birthplace of Freedom, it actually hasn't got a lot of huge amount of support in regards to adventure paths set in Andorra. And when I say not a huge amount, there's literally one that barely touches on it. But it has, from the very beginning, had a few 3.5 modules and some society stuff. So the very first mention of Andorran in any of the society things was actually in Pathfinder Society scenario number 10, Blood at Dralkard Manor. So that was based in Andorran. It used all custom maps within the scenario itself. But that was released in November 2008 for D&D 3.5 in Season 0. So it has been around for a long, long time, but unfortunately hasn't had a huge amount of support. But some of that support we have touched on before, as I know that our Dead Aussie Gamer loves it, his first foray in, is now going to kind of run through that little series.
Yeah, no, so, you know, a lot of people have asked me over the time that I've been playing, like, you know, what is some of the best ways to, like, lead into Pathfinder. And I say, like, if you get a chance to play Pathfinder First Edition, then you want to play this series. There's a little conversion that you'll need to do from 3.5 to Pathfinder, of course, but one thing I love is that there are four books that are all set in the same region of the Darkmoon Vale that cover an immense story. Starting with Hollow's Last Hope, which takes place and introduces the town of Falcon's Hollow, which is, as we mentioned before, the main city in the Darkmoon Vale region. As a plague hits the town and, you know, no one's able to fix it. It's a very interesting concept because we think of this idea of disease being something that, you know, if you're in a D&D group, your cleric being able to heal you. But when you apply it to, like, a village where you don't have that many spells per day, all of a sudden people are, like, dying left, right, and center, and people are trying their hardest to try and, you know, uncover a cure. To make that cure, however, a group of adventurers have to then travel through this very, very haunted forest to find and face off against evil creatures, deal with witches, and even start exploring the ruins of an abandoned monastery by the dwarves. It creates just this very, very creepy, again, very iconic vibe for the Darkmoon Vale, which, you know, I've described before as, you know, kind of a Stephen King version of like a D&D fantasy adventure. So that's the first of these books. But Falcon Hollow doesn't just go through one catastrophe. It goes through just numerous. In the next adventure, Crown of the Kobold King, it sees a series of children mysteriously go missing. A group of adventurers, of course, needing to go and find and track down what happened to these kids. When it is discovered that they have been kidnapped by a band of very ambitious kobolds. The group has to basically then face off against the self-proclaimed kobold king who seeks to rise themselves to a grand and high station. The third book, I can't not spoil this. God damn it. I see what you did here. You tricked me into this. It's like, Michael, you can do this segment because that way you have to spoil it. Ha ha ha. Yeah.
Sets you up.
Ah, damn it. All right. Well, the third book,
I mean, it's now 13 years old, so that I'm just going to say spoilers aren't a thing at this
That's
point.
That's fair enough. I think there definitely would be a point of expiry on spoilers. But yes, the third book is Revenge of the Kobold King, which is probably my favorite in the series because, you know, if you've done your job well for the first two books, this book you've already established and gotten to know some of the people of Falcon's Hollow, and, you know, like, you've gotten to know some of the big players when, of course, after having defeated the Kobold King, well, he decides that he's not quite done with you and returns stronger and more powerful and filled with hate as, once again, he rises from the grave in order to exact his revenge for your interference in his plans to ascend. I loved it because it was a very powerful kobold as well in this book, and it goes to show even low-level monsters can become greater threats if they're defeated in a particular way. The last book in this series is Hungry Are the Dead, which is a great adventure where, in addition to having a giant plague, having the Kobold King kidnap their kids and then come back as, like, this evil undead thing, well, you know what the town could really use? more undead. So hordes of zombies start to approach and basically incur upon the lands surrounding Falcon Hollow. And, you know, it's learned that there's like this tomb filled with undead that's hidden against underneath an abandoned monastery. And there is apparently this this ghoul creation, this kind of hodgepodge amalgam of flesh and rot that's kind of wandering the area. And it's up to you to kind of deal with it. Yeah, I mean, like I said, definitely these strong kind of dark fantasy vibes exist very powerfully in this particular series of adventure. But the reason I suggested for anyone who is looking at getting into Pathfinder is because not only one, is it a great story. Hollow's Last Hope starts at level 1 and then bleeds into you know, higher levels, eventually getting to level 6 with Hungry Are the Dead. So, you know, if you love the game, if you love playing Pathfinder, you know, and you play Hollow's Last Stand, then you can actually keep that story going. But alternatively, if you, say, are an adult and have scheduling conflicts, you can simply complete Hollow's Last Hope, and it's a fantastic standalone adventure waiting for the next time that you guys can get together to play Crown of the Kobold King and then the next one. So you actually get a lot of bang for your buck with that particular series, and it's great for new players, and yeah, it's just full of awesome stuff. It's like one of my favorites.
And these are all basically from the twisted mind of Tim Hitchcock and Nicholas Loeg, these series, which are, they're incredible writers. They also teamed up on one other module that is set in Falcon's Hollow. It's not part of that quartet, but it can be kind of slotted in either just before or just after Revenge of the Kobold King, if you'd like. And that's Carnival of Tears, in case you have any characters, any people that play with you that hate clowns. This is the adventure you want.
Clown in that artwork for the actual clown is a thing of nightmares.
Oh, he's disgusting. But yeah, again, twisted mind of Tim Hitchcock and Nicholas Loeg for that. And it is an incredible one just to kind of, if they're getting sick of fighting the kobolds, they don't want to go back down. This all happens on the fields around Falcon's Hollow. It's a great little murder mayhem twist that you can kind of throw in there to break up that monotonous dungeon crawl. And I've done it this way. I've played this right in the middle of those other four, and it works really, really well. It just needs a little bit of tweaking.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I definitely say that that slotting that in there is definitely a perfect aside to the adventure as well.
They're all originally written for 3.5, easily convertible to first edition. The ones we do have for first edition, you got the Beggar's Pearl for the Society games, At Shadow's Door also for Society. Dreams of the Yellow King. I'm putting this in here because it involves a trip down the Selen River, which is obviously the border between Andoran and Tal'Dorei. But I haven't played it. I know you have, Michael, and you said that really the tie to Andoran is a little bit different.
Yeah. So that adventure I am currently playing on Saturdays with my current table, and we're in book 5 at the moment. When we got to book 3, it involved a journey up the Selen River to the town of Casimir. It was fine. It was a long journey, but one thing that I noticed while playing the book is there wasn't anything that really invited you to explore Andoran in any particular way outside of just being on the river and getting to where you needed to go. That being said, there was one NPC that Jeff definitely screamed everything about Andoran, and that was the character of Skywin Freeling, who is a halfling member of the Bellflower Network who was born and raised in Andoran. That particular character for me is, because I'm a character GM, I always have been, right? As cool as a region can be, its people are definitely a strong sign of what, you know, a nation might be like. And if you're playing Dreams of the Yellow King and you can't, you know, take the time to stop the ship and maybe go and explore a little bit of Andoran's more easterly sides of the forest, because I think that's where the Fey Forests is and stuff like that, then at the very least, take the time to, you know, focus on Skywin, really kind of bump them up into this whole, like, you know, freeing slaves and not wanting people to be in shackles and chains, freedom and, you know, the People's Council, you know, focus on those elements to build that character, and you'll have a great time with it.
Apart from that, we've got a couple of second edition Society games as well. Falcon's Descent, Flames of Rebellion, both from the Season of the Open Road. But as I mentioned, that's kind of it. There's not a huge amount of games in Andoran. It's good and bad. That means if you want to create something a little bit more bespoke, there's some good starting points, some good things to pull from. but you get to kind of control it all yourself, which I don't think is necessarily a bad thing in all honesty. A lot of the time, they're so fleshed out that it's hard to kind of fit a full campaign into somewhere. And I think Andorran is a great country for it. In saying that, we're going to get to our last bit of the segment, Creature of the Week. As we started last week with Vanessa, I've already prepped Michael on this question. Michael, favorite creature from the Pathfinder universe?
Okay, so my favorite creature has to be, by far, the Worm That Walks. The Worm That Walks has been a terrifying entity in a lot of my games. I've definitely not only tried to run many of my campaigns with this creature as a beanbag, but also try to convince a few gullible GMs to let me play one as a character. What they are is basically they're an incredibly powerful spellcaster whose personality, whose kind of energy, their soul, has had such a strong lust for life, right, that even buried, their graves were infused with eldritch magic, and as the decaying body fattened with worms and bugs and whatever decided to feast upon it, the spellcaster's dead flesh managed to merge and corrupt the creatures that consumed it. And even though it is now split apart into fragments, the hive mind of all these creatures now walks together as a mass and clings to the vague shape of the original human. Humanoid, granting it their new existence. It's still able to, kind of use their powers and abilities that the spellcaster had in life. It retains the memory of the life that the spellcaster had before its death. And here's the biggest kicker. It is not considered undead. Despite the really gruesome origin story, it's not an undead. And I thought that was amazing, because obviously you tell people about that story and they're just like, aha, turn undead. And I'm like, you fool. These things are wiggly and awesome and great. They're not only incredibly strong, they are very perceptive due to the bug swarm, having all round vision and tremor sense as a common thing. But then also, depending on the type of makeup that they have, they can also have just a bunch of different properties, depending on A, what they're made of, and B, how creative your GM can be. So, I had one where it was actually a hive of hornets that had actually built a hive around the body of this guy. And his body basically just became like this swarm of hornets, for example. You can do a lot of really cool things with the Worm That Walks. Because just because it says worm doesn't necessarily mean like earthworms, though they're very cool as well.
Yeah, it just means vermin. My personal favorite thing about them is that they are completely immune to critical hits and flanking. Whenever you have a creature like that, it really screws with a party that's built around a rogue or something like that, for instance.
Oh, yeah, and especially when people start throwing fireballs out and you're like,
You see, that's more dangerous because it's a splash weapon. But area of effect does do more damage to it. So it definitely spellcasting teams can take these things down quickly. But if you've got people who really rely on that martial, like, high crit build or, like, sneak attack build... No dice. This thing is unaffected.
And if you always want, these things also make fantastic beanbags because they also have the Discaporeate ability, which allows them to literally just reduce their hit points to zero and then just disperse in every direction. And so long as a single bug exists, 1d10 days later, it reforms.
Yep. And to top off all of that, DR15 dash. At least in first edition.
Let's see. Okay, so second edition, they have fast healing, resistance to physical, weakness to area and splash. Yeah, so they got resistance to all physical.
Yeah, which is pretty good.
And depending on their CR, because basically in second edition, it's like a template, so you apply it based on whatever level the creature was.
Yeah, it's the same as first.
Yeah, so at level 4, it's fast heal, resistance, and weakness 5. All the way up to 15, where you get back up to that 15 as well, so...
Yeah, in first edition, their fast healing is just equal to their CR.
Ugh, yeah.
It's disgusting.
Yeah.
But that kind of will wrap up our dive into Andorran. We hope you've really enjoyed listening to us at home or wherever you're listening, and if you have any questions, feel free to shoot me a message on the Hobble Goblin Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter accounts. Once more, I'd like to thank Michael, the Dead Aussie Gamer. Where can people find you, Michael?
That was my absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me. You can find me at twitch.tv/deadaussiegamer, or you can follow me on all my social medias at twitter.com/deadaussiegamer. Right now, I run and play in just a bunch of different games online. You can find me on Tuesdays at WASD20, playing on their live channel, doing Rime of the Frost Maiden. And I run a bunch of Patreon games on my own Twitch channel at twitch.tv. I think right now the most notable show that I have that isn't a Patreon game is I'm doing a Hero Forge character builder. So we basically sit down together with an audience, build characters, and then have them 3D printed so that everyone can see what they look like. And Rise of the Rune Lords, where we are playing, where actually me and a guy from Nothing Ventured, Nothing Gamed, GM Jared, are working on completing Pathfinder, Rise of the Rune Lords, Shattered Star, and Return of the Rune Lords, and converting it into second edition Pathfinder at the same time. Oh, and do you want me to? Because we were talking in the break about like how you liked Rise of the Rune Lords. Do you want me to tease you a little bit about one of the premises that we did?
Sure.
So we thought to ourselves, how do we make Rise of the Rune Lords, which has been around for ages and been a wonderful, wonderful game? How do we make it more unique? Every single character is actually a character who has come from an ancient Thessalonian city and been propelled into the future.
Ooh, interesting.
So each of the characters comes from a different city of Sin, and yeah, it's a absolute blast getting to see all the different dynamics, like the former rivalries and things like that. And then also trying to survive in a quote-unquote modern Pathfinder world has just been, yeah, it's just been incredibly, incredibly fun. And we've recently added two new cast members who represent Lust and Pride. So they're awesome. They're amazing. And we do that on Sunday nights every week. So that'll be going on indefinitely.
Definitely.
because it's a long thing, man. Like, yeah, it'll take a while to get there, but we'll get there.
Well, thank you again, Michael. I'll be back next week, of course, with another special guest. This time I'm talking with David, a.k.a. Rain, from To Have and To Roll. And we will be talking about Numeria. I'm Liam. Good night, Galarian.